Welcome to episode 187 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with David Peña Guzman. David is Associate Professor of Humanities at San Francisco State University. He specializes in European philosophy, the history and philosophy of science, and the philosophy of animal minds. He's interested in the problem of consciousness, the study of lived experience, both human and non-human, and the value of the humanities. He's previously worked at Johns Hopkins University, Laurentian University, Dillard University, and Emory University. He's the author of When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness, and he's the co-host with Ellie Anderson of the wonderful Overthink podcast. Make sure you go and subscribe. His work has been covered by the New York Times, CNN, ABC, The Atlantic, Le Parisien, El Pais, and Forbes, amongst many others. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 186 others in our timeless back catalogue. Why not let me know via a review or rating? Reviews, ratings, and sharing really help more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate and rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. One of our latest community projects is working to get the Sentientism worldview into education curricula around the world. If you'd like to find out more about that idea or help make that happen in your country, please get in touch at hello@sentientism.info via one of our groups or just message us online. Thanks for listening.
The moment where you think you've depleted the world or you have captured it in your linguistic net is precisely the moment that the world throws yet another surprise at you. Processes and natural dynamics, even among animals, are pretty good at generating spontaneously social norms without the need for this external top-down moment of revelation where moral principles are handed to us from a world that is beyond nature. Children are so good at attributing mental states to other sentient beings, to animals. We have to be broken out of that by a culture that is largely speciesist in its understanding of other life forms, to create a good impression for others in an attempt to foster relationships of peaceful coexistence with difference, right? Like, that's the function of a diplomat. What if we saw ourselves in our interactions with other animals as species diplomats?
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. And apologies for getting you up a little early in the San Francisco morning from my London time zone, but it's great to get the chance to talk to you.
Oh, no, same here. As I age, I'm becoming a morning bird rather than a night owl. So you actually didn't disrupt my sleep patterns in any significant way.
It fits, it fits. So this is going to be an emotionally challenging conversation for me because on the one hand, I have a deep, powerful jealousy of your Overthink podcast because it's a podcast that you know, people actually listen to. I think you have more 5-star reviews than I do listeners. So that jealousy is going to be difficult for me to handle. But on the flip side, I also have a rich, deeply engaged parasocial relationship with you because I've been listening to Overthink so much. So I feel like I'm part of your intimate circle of friends, even though we've never met before. So how I'll navigate that, leave it to me, but hopefully it will work out regardless.
I know. Well, the parasocial relations do go both ways since I've listened to yours as well. And, you know, it always creates this impression that one knows the other voice. And then you finally meet in person, you're like, oh, well, I have to remember that we actually are strangers to one another in a deep sense.
Yeah. That's bizarre, isn't it? Like two distinct parasocial relationships in going in different directions. So, but now we're talking. So that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Now it's transcending the para.
Exactly. We're merging and integrating the parasocial. So you know this already because it's an honor that you've been listening or watching to some of the interviews so far. But I guess it's a series of conversations about what I think of as the deepest and the most important philosophical questions, and also ones I think that most of humanity gets catastrophically wrong, and quite a few philosophers do too. So I guess the deep worldview questions of what's real and how should we best understand the universe, and the ethical questions of what matters and critically, who matters? And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which suggests that when it comes to the what's real and the epistemology questions, we use a broadly naturalistic approach, using evidence and reason and hopefully a healthy dash of humility and doubt to always imperfectly try and understand the world as well as we can. And on the ethical scope question, the clue is in the name. It suggests that all sentient beings warrant moral considerations and compassion, at least to some minimal extent. And that clearly leaves a lot still to fight over, but it suggests there's a baseline we might be able to agree and work on. But I'm very lucky in these conversations to talk to a broad diversity of different minds, some of whom agree and some of whom don't agree with that worldview. So it would be great to explore those deep philosophical questions with you.
I'm looking forward to it. I don't know how much disagreement we will get. I'm definitely partial to your way of thinking. And so hopefully there will still be some room for disagreement around the details, because that's what keeps these conversations often exciting.
Yeah.
I also share that naturalistic inclination, broadly speaking, with your interest in expanding our circle of moral concern and moral respect along the lines of what we could call sentience in this broad, all-encompassing sense.
Well, yeah, we'll see if we can find something for the YouTube gods where we can destroy each other brutally in some way.
I know, from friends to enemies in a second.
Yeah, we'll see if we can manage it. But before we go to those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work for those who don't know you already?
Well, I consider myself and am a philosopher by training, and I teach humanities courses at San Francisco State in the Bay Area in California. And my work grows out of my training in European continental philosophy, mostly French and German thought from the 19th and 20th centuries. And I did my PhD in philosophy at Emory University, where I worked primarily on questions concerning the history and the philosophy of science. And after my PhD finished, I pivoted in terms of my research toward the natural sciences, and specifically the relationship between the natural sciences and non-human forms of life. So I developed an interest in questions about animal behavior, animal cognition, animal perception, animal experience. And it all took me in the direction of animal ethics, animal politics, and where those two intersect with scientific questions about the minds of other creatures. And so that's the field that I've been working in for a few years now, although I still conduct research in various other philosophical domains that have nothing to do with this. But by and large, this is the work that I'm most passionate about today. And it's the work that has guided my trajectory now as a faculty member here in San Francisco.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you. And there does seem to be something magnetic about the topic that people sort of touch on or dance around, and then they get inexorably drawn in. And I think it's also one of those topics where it's quite hard to just do the ivory tower sort of philosophy as well. People feel a drive to do some public activism or some engagement with the wider world on these topics as well, rather than just doing the theory. But
yeah, no, I think I like the notion of magnetism around this subject, because in the same way that magnetism had a mystery in the 19th century as this kind of force that was difficult to explain that pulls objects together, I think we are coming to the realization that there is something equally mysterious and fascinating and alluring, really, about the minds of other creatures that is very attractive, to stay with that metaphor, to more than just academics. I think a lot of people who have lived with animals, including people who have not lived with animals even, they have this sense that they want to think more about what it means to share the world with other sentient beings. And so I have found that this work in particular connects to the broader world, not only because there is this large public audience that is hungry for insights into our relationships with other animals, but also because it's a field that has non-academic branches. So there is the animal welfare movement, there's the animal rights movement, and a lot of that action has connections to academia, but most of it really is happening beyond, quote unquote, the ivory tower of higher education. It's happening on the ground with people who are committed to the goal of animal liberation.
Yeah, Thank you. So let's start with the first of these bit crazily broad philosophical questions. And I feel a bit silly asking professional philosophers these questions, but I do it anyway. And I guess that is the what's real question, or not so much the what's real question, but you know, how can we try and work that out? Because I guess the way I frame a sentientism worldview is more focused on a sort of naturalistic epistemology than it is insisting on a naturalistic epistemology, sorry, ontology that says the natural world is all that exists. Although for me, they tend to link together. But for many of my guests, the story about their philosophical journey there starts from, I guess, childhood and how they grew up and whether they grew up in quite a sort of scientific minded, maybe agnostic, atheistic, naturalistically minded household or society, or maybe the one that was more influenced by spirituality or the supernatural or the religious, and how that side of their thinking has changed over time. So I don't know if that's a good place to start with your epistemological journey so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's as good a place as any, at least chronologically, it makes sense. And, you know, it's sometimes hard to know how much weight to give to those early experiences because they can always be interpreted differently depending on the starting point from which you're looking at them backwards in order to, you know, tell the story of evolution. But if I try to do that mental exercise of looking backwards at my life, there's a way of telling that story that begins with the fact that I was raised Catholic. I grew up in a very small town in Mexico that was deeply, deeply Catholic. And in fact, where Catholicism was the main driving force, the economic driving force of town life. I grew up in a pilgrimage site that was visited by lots of devout Mexicans year round. So it was a small town of about, let's say, anywhere between 5 to 10,000 people that would be overrun by a million religious pilgrims 5 times a year. So this small town would just blow up because there was, there is still a very special virgin, a manifestation of the Virgin Mary there that has indigenous roots and that appeals to and attracts a lot of Mexican people who believe in this particular virgin's power to produce miracles, especially miracles around cancer and health and longevity. And what's really interesting is that because religion in this town had this was the economic driving force, I really grew up thinking of religion largely in social terms and in financial economic terms. And so my childhood had both this deeply Catholic dimension, but also this disenchanting component in the sense that I really saw the church and faith largely as a story that we, the locals, told in order to bring in tourists. Yeah. And so I, as a child, I never really understood that we were really meant to believe the content of the stories, for instance, that I was hearing at church on Sunday mornings. And so I had this, I call it my great 11-year-old awakening when I was 10 or 11, where I realized that in some sense, people around me expected me to truly internalize the content of our Catholic faith. And I had this showdown with my mother at 11 years old, where I said, I don't want to go to church. I don't actually believe any of this. I hope you respect my choice. And much to my surprise, my mother had no problem with that, which further just confirmed my suspicion that, you know, a lot of this was just surface. It also doesn't help that in general, Catholics, we tend to be very bad at reading the Bible. You know, we usually just get our lessons from the priest. So for me, it seemed like a lot of smoke and mirrors. Later, my view about religion changed to become a little bit more sophisticated, hopefully. But it does mean that from my early teen years, I lean towards a naturalistic outlook of the world and of the cosmos. And that means that I do think the world is composed of matter, of motion, of the fundamental forces of physics. You know, there's charge, there is gravity, there is mass. And that goes a really long way in explaining the kind of universe that we inhabit. And so I am a naturalist in that regard. But that does not mean necessarily that I am a rationalist. And what I mean by that is that I don't necessarily think that our human cognitive architecture is necessarily so imperious and mighty that it is poised to uncrack all the mysteries of nature, or that human thought has the capacity to just deplete the world in an all-encompassing explanation. And so I sit somewhere between this naturalist position and maybe an an appreciation of the fact that there might be a gap between what our minds can comprehend and the structure of the world and what is possible in that world. And, you know, two things that really highlight for me this tension are precisely the areas where my mind has taken me in terms of my research. And those are questions about the nature of life, biology, and more specifically, consciousness. So I think these are very tricky areas that raise, fundamental questions about the nature of reality, about which I am very happy to think about, and I find that deeply enriching. But I want to retain a naturalist position with this understanding that doesn't quite mean that we are the kinds of creatures that are destined to understand reality from the inside out.
I really like that balance because it avoids this sort of reification of the human mind as some sort of magical thing that has almost like a replacement for God, some capability to be omniscient and perfect in some rational sense. And I think it also uses a naturalistic understanding of what we are as a type of animal, you know, as a branch on the tree of life, as an evolved ape. And that understanding, again, I think leads you to humility. You know, why should our capacity, which has evolved for certain types of evolutionary adaptability, why should that capability give us some magical ability to understand everything? So I think it feeds into that sort of more humble approach that doesn't sort of draw a barrier around what we can know and say we can definitely never know, but at least it leaves open the possibility that there may be stuff we just can't understand and maybe can never understand. So I quite like that balance.
Yeah. And I mean, you use the term humility, and I really like that. I've written in the past about epistemic humility as a standpoint that affirms the limits of one's own understanding and one's own capacity overall. Another term that I like for trying to capture this is just the term tragedy. And I think there is a tragic thread to human existence in the sense that the recognition of that humility entails an acknowledgement that the world was not made for us to understand it. The world is the world, and we happen to pop into existence at some point in evolutionary history, and we are lucky that we get to understand some parts of it, but nature was not made for human categories. Our mind, all things considered, our minds work according to really rough classifications, categorizations, schemas that nature honestly couldn't care less about. And so the tragedy, the epistemic tragedy of human existence is that the moment where you think you've depleted the world or you have captured it in your linguistic net is precisely the moment that the world throws yet another surprise at you. And so there is a kind of vice, I would say, a moral and epistemic vice or hubris in assuming that somehow the world should bow down to our human eye or to our human mind rather than the other way around.
And again, I think that evolutionary context helps because I guess our evolutionary context would be, look, it's quite useful for us as human animals to be able to understand quite well medium-sized dry goods type of stuff, right? But when it comes to quantum fields or black holes or the scale of the universe or, you know, the very nature of consciousness, you know, why should we have some privileged access to that? And it feels like quite often, even amongst, you know, humanists or atheists or skeptics or people who are very determined to move away from a religious worldview, there can be hangovers, I think, in the way they think about the human and our capacity that in a way are sort of a hangover of a religious mode of thinking. We reify ourselves to replace the deity. Or
if you're made in the image of the divine, of course there will be a, you know, that's a tall order To live up to be the image of the divine, or to be a kind of derivation of the divine. And so I think it does set us up on a pedestal that nature, as a matter of fact, denies us.
Yeah, completely. And if I can drag you back to your 11-year-old revelation, I'm interested in what drove that. So you talked already about the fact you had a bit of cynicism or skepticism there, just because you saw it as a bit of an economic business thing and you saw the stories being told and why they were being told. When you made that declaration that you didn't believe in these things, was it driven from a sort of facts and evidence thing where you'd actually engaged with the stories and thought it through somewhat rationally and said, you know, the evidence just doesn't stack up here? Or, as with some of my other guests, was it also because you looked at some of the values or the ethics that was embedded in a Catholic worldview, and were there some challenges there? Or was it more just, you know, the facts and the evidence, and or a mix of the two?
If anything, I would say the former, but I think that's giving my 11-year-old past self too much credit. I don't think
you
my
11-year-old... You were reading Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy. And...
Yes, I was not reading Darwin's On the Origin of Species, you know, thinking about how this upends the religious worldview that I grew up with. I think it really was more of a realization that something that I thought was folklore, other people expected me to adopt as a metaphysics. And
you never really believed it, and you didn't think you were being expected to believe it. And then when that
exactly,
became clear,
exactly,
that was the revelation. So in a way, you weren't really changing your mind. You were just like, hold on a minute. Yeah, okay.
Yes, other people, my perception of other people's perception of what's going on has changed. I thought we were all in together on this, you know, kind of story that we're telling tourists to make sure they buy our trinkets. Again, I want to emphasize that that's not my interpretation of religious faith. And in fact, I sort of came back culturally to the church when I was a teenager after I moved to the US. So I grew up in Mexico. At age 15, I emigrated to the United States. I landed in a very small desert town in the middle of Nevada as a 15-year-old queer Mexican kid who didn't speak English. And I spent two really difficult years of just social isolation in that environment.
Yeah, that's got to be hard.
Yeah, and it was in that context that I rediscovered the church, not religiously, but culturally, because it was the only place where I could see other Latinos, where I could see other people who were Hispanophones. And so I latched onto the church there existentially as a kind of last second, what is the term for those like inflatable things in the ocean?
It's like a life like belt. A life belt, all right, yeah, clinging on.
Yeah, and so I do think, I do have a respectful view of the role that religion plays in people's lives. But when I was young, I did believe that it was the great open secret that we all shared with one another about our lack of faith about this thing that we profess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought we were all on the same page. And when I realized that contents of the religious faith were beginning to be used to police my actual behavior, or that I was expected to police my own behavior according to the contents of the faith, that's where something didn't feel right to me. But I can't say that it was an intellectually mature refutation.
Yeah.
Or a critique of the ethics or politics of Catholicism.
Thank you. So this story about religion or non-religion is obviously a pretty resonant part of the epistemological journey of many people in today's society, because most people are still brought up with a religious mindset. And it does often provide them with the set of epistemological tools. You know, there are certain areas where you use evidence and reason, but there are other areas where you might use faith or revelation and so on. So it's always an interesting part of the story. But that's not the only thing epistemology is about, of course. There are all sorts of other things that have nothing to do with religion. And you could look at timely topics like misinformation, disinformation, conspiracism, you know, all sorts of other areas of life where people ground beliefs inaccurately, and that can cause harm in various ways. And that's part of my motivation for proposing a sort of naturalistic view, because it, as you've said, it doesn't guarantee you'll get the right answers, but seems to have the best chance. You know, engaging with reality honestly seems to be the best chance we've got of understanding it reasonably well. And I like the humility and the inbuilt sort of error detection of that process, that you're never dogmatically stuck. You're always open-minded about new evidence and new reasoning so that you can keep trying to get less wrong over time. But one other interesting challenge to that sort of naturalistic approach, or certain framings of it, can come from the continental philosophy that you've done a lot of work in as well. And that challenge, personally, I don't really think it is a challenge, but it doesn't have to be a challenge, comes from a strong focus on the subjective. And you've done work around lived experience. You did a great episode with Ellie on standpoint epistemology as well. And there are modes of thinking there, which at least are sort of challenging a simplistic naturalistic view that there is one objective reality that we all share and we can come to a perfect understanding of it, and challenges that with some view of the distinctiveness of and the separateness of subjective experiences. So how does that type of thinking play into your naturalism? Is it a challenge, or is it actually part of your naturalism?
So I think it is both a challenge and a complement to it, in the sense that I share a naturalistic, perhaps with you, a naturalistic understanding of the emergence of subjectivity itself. So I think sentience, consciousness, and more speaking now at a lower level, life emerges through evolutionary processes from the physical world. And so in that sense, there is no additional substance that exists in our universe that we can call the soul or the elan vital or the living principle. But it does then mean that we have a challenge of explanation. So I see it as continuous in terms of emergence, but I see there being an explanatory gap actually between the way in which we explain the behavior of physical nature and the kinds of explanations that we need to give about the living and the sentient, and whether or not those explanations are reducible to physical explanations. And so that's the movement that I resist. It's an anti-reductionist view of the relationship between sentience, biology, and physics. And so for me, the two sort of go hand in hand. And the reason that there is a challenge there is because, as people have known and argued since the 17th century, when modern physics is emerging, physics is really good at explaining structures, at explaining functions, and at giving us a picture of quote unquote objective nature. But physics just doesn't really have the language or the tools or the concepts to explain the subjective. The philosopher Alexander Coiré has a really wonderful article about this, where he looks at early modern scientists like Newton, for example, Isaac Newton, and he says, look, even they were deeply aware of this problem, and they did not have this pretense that they were doing anything other than explaining fundamental laws about the physical world. Once you introduce mind, it does seem to be a phenomenon that requires a different order of explanation. And so that's where I see continuity, but with some complications in terms of our explanation of the thing in question.
Yeah, thank you. That makes sense. And it's difficult because in a way that explanatory gap can lead you back to implying that there is a distinct phenomena that is a bit like the soul you were talking about earlier on that you don't want to accord. So it's quite an interesting dynamic about how you take that non-reductionist approach, but avoid, you know, a dualism or going back to an idea of a distinct soul or something separate.
Yeah. And, you know, there are different ways to go about that. Of course, some people are substance dualists who just assert the existence of these two separate things that are fundamental. That would be the Cartesian strategy. Other people take a weaker version of that, which is property dualism, according to which, no, there is really just one kind of substance and it's all physical, but maybe that physical stuff can have multiple properties that are themselves not always physical. So think about gravity, for example. You know, is it reducible to matter and motion, or is it its own separate thing? And maybe is consciousness and sentience something else that is also kind of fundamental, like another force of physics? Of course, that raises question then about how do we understand that force? How do we explain its relationship to physical processes, so on and so forth? And there are a lot of people doing great work on this nowadays, including philosophers, psychologists, neuroscientists, and physicists often working together. I don't specialize in the question of the relationship between physics and consciousness. In many ways, I just bypass this problem altogether. Yeah. Very conveniently, I don't talk about this really difficult thing. And that's because I do think, for me, what really matters is the fact that consciousness exists, that it exists in the animal kingdom. And what I try to do in my work, rather than tackle those maybe more fundamental questions, is try to unravel the implications of the fact that other living beings are sentient, and trying to understand through a combination of empirical research, but also some philosophical speculation, what their experience of the world might entail. And so that's how I position myself in this broader field of consciousness studies, which, you know, is very vast and broad and interdisciplinary.
Yeah, makes sense. I shamelessly take a similar approach of sort of copying out of some of the difficult stuff. So, and that's part of the idea behind sentientism, is it's actually quite neutral on, you know, lots of different beliefs we might have, as long as we take a naturalistic approach. It's neutral on philosophy of mind. So there are sentientists that, you know, ascribe to panpsychism or substance dualism or a more sort of reductionist physicalist approach. So there's all sorts of, you know, fascinating things that go on there. My personal view tends towards, I guess, the more reductionistic, in that my guess is that sentience and consciousness are essentially evolved classes of computation that happen to be going on in our brain. So I take a sort of more monist approach, where I just think those are useful concepts for describing what is happening here, and there is nothing distinct or nothing separate. But yeah, many sentientists disagree.
I think we found the apple of discord then, that we were looking for at the beginning, that then it turns this into a highly combative, going excellent, for the jugular excellent sort of interaction, only because I have found persuasive what is now called, or it has been called now, it's been 20 years since this concept has been around, the hard problem of consciousness, which is that you can correlate experiential states, phenomenal states, with underlying brain states and the kinds of information processing that is going on there. So we can say, you know, the experience of color is correlated with this brain state, the experience of face recognition with this brain state. What is still missing from contemporary science, and we don't even know what this would look like, even in theory, is an explanation as to why those states are conscious, and other states that also process information, that also have a particular structure and a particular neural profile, are not. And so I do think that there is a limit to that reductionism. So this is, I think, a place where maybe we deviate, even though, as I said before, my own work doesn't quite target these questions. In many ways, I bypass them in order to focus on the thing that I really find shiny, which is this more speculative exercise in trying to figure out how other animals might experience the world, and how we might even know that, and what political and ethical and social implications fall from that exercise.
Yeah, and we'll come on to that in the next question. And I guess that perspective also, for me, answers this question about, you know, the valence of lived experience or standpoint epistemology. And the way I reconcile the two is to see that, in a sense, our subjective experiences, whatever they are in terms of their ultimate nature, are a part of the natural world we all share. So I think the subjective is, in a sense, part of this shared objective reality. And that leaves, you know, two things can be true, right? We can all share one theoretically objective reality, but at the same time, our distinct subjective perspectives, because of our positionality and because of our genes and because of our brains and because of our experiences, are by definition always going to be distinct within that world. So we don't have to give up on the idea that objective reality exists. You know, it's not a purely social construction, but at the same time, we don't have to have this naive view that deprecates the subjective or ignores the subjective and sort of tries to crush it because it says, look, there's just one reality that exists. I think there's quite an easy middle way there that recognizes both.
Yeah, and I think the middle way does the most justice not only to the great success of the scientific project since the 1600s, but it also does justice to what, according to some people, we know best and most, which is precisely that subjective dimension. So we know a lot about physics, right?
In a way, that's all we know, right?
In fact, it's the first thing we know.
Yeah.
And all we know. So it's like the alpha and the omega of
everything
our experience.
Everything else comes through it, yeah.
Through it and as a result of it. And so the thing that I can be the most certain of is the fact that I am experiencing things. So I hear, you know, I'm maybe returning to Descartes somewhat unexpectedly, but the experience is our starting point. And so any cosmology, metaphysics, ontology, or theory of nature that denies that is already working against, sort of what is given first and foremost to us. And if it turns that into an illusion or into an epiphenomenal reality, I think many of us have this kind of deep-seated knee-jerk aversion to that, because in many ways, our reality is our subjective experience. But it is something that is embedded in this larger, shared, intersubjective, and I want to emphasize natural world that is common.
Yeah, thank you. So let's come on to the second big question, and this is switching to the world of ethics, which is, I guess, the question of what matters, if anything does. And that's a classic challenge that can be put to people with a naturalistic worldview from someone who maybe has a religious worldview, because they might have a deity, they might have heaven and hell, they might have a book with rules, and they might claim that's some sort of objective moral standard, which we could argue about, because you could say, well, the subject in your morality just happens to be a deity, so that's subjective too. But anyway, it's a challenge often to people with a naturalistic worldview is, why does anything matter? So what's your journey been about thinking about ethics and what matters? What are good and bad and right and wrong? Are those sorts of things even mean?
Yeah, so my thinking about the relationship between nature and ethics grows out of a sense that a naturalistic worldview does not entail, as a lot of people think, a sudden moral cynicism or even fatalism in which nothing matters. There is no right or wrong. Therefore, in the most simplistic, horrific version of this, I can do whatever I want without moral consequences. And I think a lot of people by now, over the course of the 20th century and the late 19th century, so since the development of the Darwinian theory of evolution, have done work to show that, in fact, natural processes and natural dynamics, even among animals, are pretty good at generating spontaneously social norms without the need for this external top-down moment of revelation where moral principles are handed to us from a world that is beyond nature. And so this sphere of anarchy, I think, is, and I hear me mean moral anarchy or theological anarchy, is rooted in the sense, in a problematic theory of nature, according to which what's natural is just the battle of the wild, you know, where when nature is red in tooth and claw, as if animals didn't show us that they have relations of empathy and care and mutual aid on their own. And so my thinking about this grows out of this recognition that you can have ethics without this top-down moment of revelation that we typically get from religion. In my own case, I have worked through the ethical question on two grounds. And one of them is a phenomenological, let's say, account of intersubjectivity, where when I encounter another person, it's not as if I just see one object among many other objects. I see Peter or Samantha over there. They are utterly indistinguishable from that piece of bread or that trash can that is next to them. in fact, when we perceive other people, we perceive their minds sort of directly or sui generis. We just grasp the fact that they are a minded being from the way in which they behave and from the kinds of interactions that we have with them, without me having to rationally think about whether or not they are individuals who matter because they have a perspective of their own. And this means that I actually see the so-called problem of other minds that has caused so much ink to be spilled in ethics and the philosophy of mind, to a large extent as a pseudo problem when it comes to ethics, because it's not as if I ever walk around wondering, you know, like, oh, I wonder if the person that is handing me my coffee deep down is a robot without an inner life. I think that that question really emerges only once you step out of the flow of lived experience. In the flow of lived experience, what we encounter is, in fact, a difference between inanimate objects and subjects. And the only difference is that I think that this argument, which a lot of phenomenologists have already made about other humans, I simply extend also to other sentient beings. I do think that when I interact with a dog, I sort of experience their dog-mindedness just from the interaction, without having to do an inferential pirouette in my mind to draw a conclusion on the basis of certain evidence that is presented to me. In fact, I think this is why children are so good at attributing mental states to other sentient beings, to animals. Children do this spontaneously. And in fact, we have to be broken out of that by a culture that is largely speciesist in its understanding of other life forms. So the fact that many of us don't do that is not an indication that it's not a part of our perceptual logic. I take that to be rather an indictment of the kind of cultural norms that we inherit from the past and that we internalize, and that lead us to withhold the attribution of mind to beings that we otherwise naturally would mind, in the sense of care for and attribute mental states to. So that's one central component of my thinking. It's this phenomenological interpretation of what it means to perceive a sentient creature.
That seems to map really cleanly, although most people maybe wouldn't use the term intersubjectivity, right? But it maps onto quite a common sense view of ethics and morality that, you know, yes, there's virtue ethics and feminist care ethics and deontology and utilitarianism and all the others. But in some basic common sense form, morality is about whether and how we care for others, and caring for others means recognizing their subjectivity, their perspective, their interests, their needs, and acting with that in mind. So it seems sort of like quite a common sense, richly grounded approach. Yeah. So,
yeah. And I think it is consistent with recognition-based theories of intersubjectivity that come to us from philosophical traditions like Hegelianism. And it is also consistent with developmental psychology facts that we get from experiments on how infants and children move through the world when you introduce living beings into their environment. You know, of course, we can make mistakes about that attribution of mental states. So, you know, there has been some work around robots. If you make a robot that looks like a dog, and you show people kicking that dog, a lot of people have this like, oof, I feel awkward, I feel uncomfortable, even though, of course, that robot doesn't have feelings. It's really just like a very sophisticated, complex printer, or, you know, just like a really like second degree Keurig coffee maker. And some people have argued that the fact that we make these mistakes shows that maybe we don't really perceive the world in this way. But if anything, for me, the argument cuts the other way. The fact that we make mistakes and over-attribute mental states in cases where maybe we shouldn't just shows how deeply embedded this tendency to attribute mental states to other living beings actually runs. And so to say that it's, let's say, a natural inclination is not to say that it's infallible. It's just to say that it's something that we spontaneously do because of the kinds of beings that we are.
Yeah. And like you say, you can sort of take a more formal inferential approach. You can talk about evolutionary context and history. You can talk about information processing architectures. You can talk about behavior and communications. Or you, as you're saying, you can look into the eyes of a puppy and sort of bypass that emotionally and intuitively and have this, like, as you were saying, a sort of direct sense of there being another subject there. So
the first point of my thinking about ethics and nature is this phenomenological interpretation of the perceptual nature of other minds, the fact that we just perceive those minds in the body, in the lived body of other sentient creatures. The second principle, or the second axis, I would say, of my thinking about this, hinges on the question, what exactly is it that we are perceiving in that moment of perception? So right now I see you, it gets complicated when it's a two-dimensional screen, but let's say I perceive another person, what exactly am I perceiving? And it's not really for me that I somehow perceive your deepest essence when you enter into my perceptual field. It's not as if I have suddenly this perfect vision where I see right through you and I somehow understand the truth of your being.
Yeah, there's no magical telepathic connection.
Yeah, exactly. There is no Edenic vision. So in the Bible, Adam is given perfect vision such that when he sees the animals, he can see their essence. And that's why he has the power to name them. So he sees the horse, and this really in the Bible, in the story of Genesis, is rooted in his capacity to see through and see the essence of things. So I don't think that's how human perception works.
Yeah. Although, as an aside, it might also be why the Garden of Eden was vegan. So maybe there's something there.
Yeah. And so I think what we actually experience in our perception of other minds is something akin to a limit, to a certain opacity. Because when I encounter another living being and I experience them as a subjectivity that is different than mine, what I'm really experiencing in that moment is their irreducibility to my own perspective, right? So suddenly there is this other universe, this other subjective universe over there that is not mine. And in the same way that they are appearing as an object in my perceptual field, I am appearing as an object in their perceptual field. So suddenly you have this doubling relationship that enters into the scene. And I often use, just to stay with the language of vision here, I use the language of opacity to thematize this irreducibility or this resistance, in the sense that when I encounter, I have, a physical object here, some post-it notes. When I look at this, in theory, I could have that kind of perfect vision about it if I just know all the physical facts about this object. If I know the dimensions and the mass and the composition, okay, I see what it is. I understand how it was produced, etc. And so I see through it, in a sense. With other beings, because of the presence of mind, there is an opacity. My vision cannot penetrate. And so I think when we perceive other minds, what we perceive is that opacity, that resistance to us. And that is what triggers the experience of moral concern. The reason I care about dogs and cats and giraffes and alligators and my neighbor Victoria is because all in their different way are a limit to my subjectivity because they are another subjectivity. And so my thinking about the relationship between ethics and nature then comes down to these two points, that subjectivity emerges out of nature at some point. We can tell an evolutionary story about that. And then the way in which subjectivities relate to one another has this duality of immediate grasp, but a grasp of a kind of opacity.
Yeah. And if, I guess, my more reductionist approach turns out to be right, and in a few hundred years, we develop an amazing brain scanning technology that can actually give you the ability to emulate in your head what's going on in mine. So you genuinely break through that opacity and you really could experience what it's like to be me, maybe with a time limit so that you can jump back to being you after 30 seconds. would that undermine your ethical thinking, or would your moral concern for my perspective be there even if it wasn't opaque? What it is about the opacity that makes it significant, rather than it just being a blocker to empathy or a limit to empathy?
So I think this is a really, really good question, because we often say, well, if I could step into the shoes of another person, I would truly understand them. Whereas I think, on my way of thinking, if I truly were to become you, in many ways, the ethical relationship between us would disappear.
Because you are them.
Because you would disappear yeah. into me, and I would disappear in,
yeah.
well, I wouldn't disappear into you. You would disappear into me, right? And that lack of opacity.
Or be copied, maybe.
yeah. And so I think that lack of opacity, the sense that I know you inside and out, would phenomenologically reduce you to, you know, this, you'd be a more complicated version of my post-it notes. And so I worry that, theoretically, assuming that that thought experiment were materially possible, I think that that would actually have quite disastrous implications for moral life if you can reduce a person to another person. And moreover, of course, there is the empirical question of whether that is possible or not. I have doubts, very serious doubts about that. But even beyond that, I have this fear that what sometimes seems like this maybe optimistic attitude about our scientific future, that, you know, maybe in the future we will get to this point, would only set us up for a really dark form of nihilism when that moment comes. Because when that moment comes and we lose that inter of the intersubjective, I don't really understand what social life means in a world when I have complete understanding of the motivations and desires of every other living being around me. What motivates me to care, to show interest, to start a conversation? It seems like the very motivation for social life would be pulled out from under our feet.
And in a way, they've ceased to be an other. At that moment.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. So, and without others, what is ethics and morality? Yeah.
Yeah. It would seem like the universe would become just the overflowing of the same. And the same here would just be the self. And so that seems like a really dark world for me to be in, a world without metaphysical or phenomenological or ontological diversity.
Thank you. Yeah, it's fascinating. Now, one of the criticisms that's often leveled at some of the continental philosophers when it comes to philosophy and morality and ethics is that the focus on the subjective can lead some of them towards a more relativistic form of morality and ethics that doesn't particularly privilege any basic moral standard. It just says, well, it's sort of up to different groups politically to agree a set of moral codes and standards. And if we stand outside of that, who are we to judge what they have descriptively developed in their own political dynamic? Whereas others, and I'd fall into this camp, my view of, you know, caring about the subjective and caring about the other is explicitly why I reject a relativistic ethic, because I care about all of the others and their experiences matter to me, regardless of, you know, moral codes or political structures. How do you think through that challenge? Because you talked before about, you know, you reject the sort of nihilistic approach that just says there's no such thing, we're all just physics churning away. How do you think about the relativistic ethics as another sort of stance that's quite common?
Yeah, so I do have to say, just here thinking about the more specific part of the question that targets this division within academic philosophy of analytic versus continental, that I think the criticism of continental philosophy as relativistic in its weak form is largely uninteresting, because I do accept a kind of relativism, whether that is about the existence of multiple perspectives that we talked about. Different beings have different cognitive architectures. So to that extent, their perception does not converge. And in fact, may be unable to converge if there are reasons to believe that there are fundamental gaps between their modes of experiencing reality. So in its weak form, it just seems to be kind of what science also tells us, the more we learn about.
Descriptively obvious, yeah.
Yeah, it just seems, again, uninteresting. It also seems uninteresting if it is applied temporally or historically, because we do know that moral codes change over time. And I am a historical contingency, let's say, theorist about social norms, social institutions. A lot of principles evolve over time, including the principles of science itself. You know, our understanding of science now is not the same as it was in the 18th or the 17th centuries. And so there is a way in which what is possible changes across time as our understanding of the world evolves, but also across space when we think about different positions. And you alluded to this episode that I did with my co-host Ellie Anderson in Overthink, in trying to think about what that kind of standpoint theory tells us about the limits of our perspective and about how multiple perspectives can coexist. And so in its weak form, it seems to me uninteresting as a criticism of continental philosophy. In its stronger form, it just seems to me false, in the sense that most of the people that are accused of being relativistic or irrationalistic in the continental camp are nothing of the sort when you have a good sense of the inner mechanics of their philosophical systems. And I myself have a branch of my own work where I have tried to pick, you know, the poster children of continental irrationalism. I've taken the criticism that is often made of them, which is that they reject science and they reject reason. And I have published a few articles sort of showing that, in fact, the inverse is true, that many of these thinkers deeply cared about science. Often they were providing us with imminent critiques of the science of their time, showing how the science that was available to them did not live up to its own standards in various ways, its own standards of evidentiary support, its own standards of inference, so on and so forth. And I think this is true, for example, of Nietzsche. I think this is true. Certainly, I wrote an article on this about the French philosopher Henri Bergson, who is often presented as the irrationalist par excellence. I wrote also an article about Simone de Beauvoir's critique of biology and gender, showing that, in fact, she really cared about biology. She was just struggling to make sense of the claims that biologists were making.
Yeah, that's what's motivating the critique often. It's not.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, in connection to continental philosophy, I occupy an interesting position because I do call myself a continentalist. I was trained at a continental program at Emory University, but I also work in very close relationship with the sciences. And often people think that's bizarre and that that's a departure from the norm. But many people in my tradition have done that. Merleau-Ponty has done that. Husserl has done that. Even Heidegger was a close reader of multiple biologists. Deleuze was a very close reader of the sciences of his time. And so I actually see myself as continuing rather than rejecting a certain continental trajectory or historical legacy that tries to raise questions that go beyond science, starting from the science of one's time. And this is what I do in my book about the dreams of animals.
And that's a perfect segue, because the second part of the question, which you've answered already, is this question of who matters. Because I think many people would agree with your sort of intersubjectivity stance, where you're recognizing the perspective of others and morality in some senses, you know, about that. But they would stop with humans. Again, I think you're right that, you know, normally because of the way they've been trained by culture and society to restrict their compassion, they've almost been pushed away from their childhood compassion that stretches beyond that. And it would be great to get into your work, When Animals Dream, but I'm also interested in your personal journey thinking about moral scope, because again, you know, how did you grow up thinking about these things? How did you think about moral scope within the human species? And then what were the breakpoints when you started to take non-human animal ethics seriously in your moral consideration, and how did that journey play out? And then maybe, yeah, it'd be wonderful to get into when animals dream and your thinking there.
Yeah, so I think like a lot of people, I grew up with a lot of contradictions around animals. So here, flashback back to infant David growing up in Mexico. I grew up in a household where pets were not allowed. My grandmother had a ban against animals in the house. And so I grew up largely alienated from domestic companions. So that experience that a lot of people have of how they became animal lovers, you know, because the Fido and Max and whatever other animals that populated the familial space, that was not the case for me. The only animal that was allowed in our house were a couple of canaries that my grandmother kept in very small cages. And I always thought that was horrendous. And my mother hated these canaries because it was just such a sad scene of these birds in small cages right by the kitchen. So nobody wanted them around except my grandmother. And so I grew up without the positive kind of emotion building, emotion bonding connections to domestic companions, but rather with this sense that keeping animals caged and imprisoned was unsettling for reasons that I couldn't quite articulate. At the same time, my grandfather, when I was very young, was a butcher. And I don't have very many memories of that. I have vague memories of his life. It's rather something that's come to me from, you know, our family oral tradition. But he was a rancher who had a ranch with cattle. There were cows, there were donkeys, there were horses and dogs and cats and a lot of natural wildlife. And I grew up regularly going to the ranch to help. And so I had this duality where I appreciated life in the countryside, but always with this unease around the fact that I knew the cows would be sold for slaughter, that the horses were only there to do physical labor for us. And with the sense that the only animals that we seem to have a kind of closer relationship with were those birds in those tiny cages. So just overall, I would say an uneasy connection to animals as a child. But I never really thought about it in clear terms. I grew up, I moved to the US, and when I was a teenager at 15, 16, we had a dog. And that began this shift in my perspective about animals in very subtle ways. I continued my studies. I went away to college. I went to grad school. I was doing other things that I thought were fascinating about philosophy and French thought and the history of science. Animals were nowhere to be found. And then suddenly, through a series of random events, I stumbled upon a course on animal philosophy, and it triggered in me a kind of, let's say, eureka moment. Although I don't like that language because it seems mythic. Rather, it triggered in me an awareness of how poorly all the animals that I lived with had been treated, both by me and the people around me. And it prompted me to continue to read more, to work more on the subject. And at some point I did decide, oh, actually, this is mattering more and more to me, to the point that I actually need to make some decisions, A, about my intellectual trajectory, and B, about how that trajectory does or does not mirror my life choices, my mode of living. And I became a vegetarian. I decided to specialize on animal philosophy. And that's how then a couple of years later, I ended up publishing this book, When Animals Dream, that is about the inner mental world of other animals, focusing specifically on what happens during sleep, whether or not animals have these inner simulations of reality that we call dreams, and what that might tell us about the kind of consciousness that they have.
And what was your, because it's a fascinating angle, because most of the thinking about consciousness and most of the science about consciousness and sentience deals with you know, animals and human animals while we're awake. So what took you into thinking about them while they're sleeping? And it's a fascinating book, because the book I can see most obviously behind you, The Hidden Spring, written one of my previous guests, Mark Solms.
Yeah.
Had a fascinating conversation with him about the evolution of sentience and how that developed, because he was one of the people who did some of the foundational work around working out where in the human brain dreaming seems to go on as well. So you and he both seem to have picked the sleeping brain as a fascinating lens.
Yeah. I think one reason for focusing on the sleeping brain is that it's not been as studied as the waking brain or as the waking animal. Most of the work that you find in the animal sciences about animal attention, animal cognition, animal perception is based on experiments and studies that are done for obvious reasons when animals are awake. You know, you make animals do tests, you make them run a maze, you observe their behavior with con specifics. And there are very good reasons for that. You know, that's sort of where we naturally go for our understanding of other minds. But for me, this left unanswered a question, which was, do they also have an offline processing that is lived in the same way we do, or in different ways, but ways that are still kind of analogous, and that's dreaming, right? Do they have dreams, and what kind of dreams do they have? And that's what prompted me to write this book. Initially, it was meant to be a short article, and it just was bursting at the seams. And it became clear to me that there is here an entry point through dreams into a way of thinking about animal consciousness that actually opens up into way more than dreams. It opens onto questions of animal memory, because of course, dreams have a very close connection to past experience. It opens up to questions about attention, and the way in which animals scan the environment, because in dreams we scan the environment as well. There are questions here about animal imagination, which for me is fascinating. Do animals have the capacity to imagine things that are not there in their objective surroundings? I mean, we're talking about what for a lot of philosophers has been the hallmark of our humanity, our capacity to mentally travel away from the here and now. And so what I do in this book is I try to give a comprehensive theory of the dreaming animal mind, and again, extract some ethical lessons at the end of the book that follow from that kind of curiosity about the operations of other minds.
And I'm very much an amateur in this space, but it does seem to me that there's a pattern in the research about non-human animals that we very rarely do a new study or do some new research and find out that animals have less capability than we thought they did. It's nearly always more and more. Is that something that played through as you were gathering the research and thinking about dreaming? Was dreaming more widespread than you'd expected when you started?
It definitely was more widespread than I thought. To be honest, I thought it might just be mammals that turn out to be dreamers. And to my surprise, very early on, that's not the case. There are a lot of different species that dream that are not mammals. It just so happens that mammals are the animals that we study the most in laboratories. And so we have the most evidence about them. But it doesn't mean that other species don't have their own version of this capacity. And one that became very important for me was the case of octopuses. First, because they are invertebrates, so they are very, very different from us, and they are on a totally distant branch of the tree of life, a different taxon altogether. And so it suggests that either dreaming is so ancient that it was already there at the time when vertebrates and invertebrates split, or is such an important capacity for whatever reason that it emerges spontaneously at various moments in the evolution of life. And so it's a very good case of convergent or parallel evolution. And I don't take a position on which of those two is true, because I'm not an evolutionary theorist. What I really care about, again, is the fact that the evidence is there for other animals dreaming. and then trying to really tease apart what follows from that. But in the book, I talk about mammals, I talk about birds, I talk about invertebrates, cephalopods, like octopuses and cuttlefish. And since the book has been published, there's been new research that expands it even further into arthropods. Now there is some really interesting work out there on whether or not bees dream, on whether or not spiders dream. And I was recently told in an interview that I did for an Australian show that there is a researcher doing work on whether worms have reverberatory nerve activity during periods of rest, which would be a very, very simplified form of dreaming, you know, in extremely quote unquote simple animals. And so it really blows up the scope of animals that are included in the category.
And how did you draw that back to, I guess, the ethical and moral implications of how we think about our treatment and relationship of other animals? And I guess, you know, there are a bunch of practical fields, you know, one which is a tricky subject really is the field of animal research itself and the ethics of that. But of course, the big beast of animal agriculture, whether it's meat or dairy or eggs or, you know, other sorts. What sort of lessons did you draw from dreaming that were maybe distinct from just thinking about a sentiocentric ethic that says, you know, all sentient beings matter? What does the capacity to dream layer onto that?
So the last chapter of the book, which is the most philosophically technical one, because it deals with these very specific debates in philosophy about moral status, about who matters, on what grounds, how do we know? There, I tried to make a connection between dreams and moral significance by talking about the fact that dreams are the kind of experience that we should care about when being arbiters of which organisms matter morally and which entities don't matter morally in our field of vision or perception, broadly speaking. And that's because to dream, by definition, is to have a lived experience of something that manifests itself to you. So it's a perceptual reality in relation to which you have a certain kind of affect. So it's a combination of a perceptual field that is affectively charged. And for me, that's how I think about sentience. In fact, I think about sentience as the opening up of a world of experience for an animal, independently of how complex or simple that world is, and as it opening a world in which the animal then acts and moves because they develop certain interests. And the notion of interest or affect, I don't want to confuse that with emotion, which is already too cognitive. I really think about it just in terms of things that feel good or bad for the animal.
It's like some minimal valence is another term people use.
Yeah, kind of hedonic valence, where there are attractors and repellents in that world that drive the animal to navigate that lived space. And when you think about sentience like that, I make the argument in its logical form that it is impossible, in fact, it's inconceivable to have a dreamer that doesn't have that basic sentience capacity, that phenomenal consciousness. And so it's just baked into dreaming and in a way that I think really crystallizes the moral significance. And beyond that, what dreaming adds that maybe we don't get with sentience is that it clarifies for us what in my work I call the world-building power of other animals. We know that human experience is very complex because there is an active principle that we bring to the table as subjects. You know, we don't just experience the world exactly as it is. There is an active construction, an active curating of reality that our minds and bodies are constantly doing.
Yeah, in a sense, we're almost creating a real-time simulation of reality in our own heads.
Yes, exactly. And the problem is that in the waking world, because we are interacting with external reality, it's very easy to miss or to forget that creative component, the fact that we are building and we are producing and constituting the world of experience at all times. But when you turn to dreams, dreams highlight, they underscore that creative dimension, because what's happening is that you are creating a world under the most radical conditions imaginable, which are conditions of sensory motor disconnect from the world.
Yeah, you're doing it without the perceptual inputs, at least at that moment. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so it highlights something that is, I think, going on at all times in a way that makes it very difficult to deny. And so that's the appeal for me of dreams, aside from the fact that dreams, of course, in the history of culture and the history of art have had this poetic, magnetic, to go back to that concept from the beginning, this magnetic power, because there's truly something fascinating about dreams. The fact that our minds fly when our bodies are resting, and the fact that other animals do that too, for me is a testament to the fact that they are subjects with a rich inner life, but again, subjects that we don't understand completely and that will always have that element of opacity that I often go back to again and again in my work.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. Yeah, it's almost like a purer, crisper, more crystalline version of sentience, right? Because it's disconnected from, you know, the reality of day-to-day that's going on. That's fascinating. Thank you. Now, this is deeply unfair to do because I know we've only got 3 or 4 minutes left, but the final question is, how can we make a better future? Given we share a broadly naturalistic approach, and I think we broadly share this sort of sentiocentric compassion that sentient beings matter, at least to some minimal level, and I'd like to suggest non-maleficence is a baseline for that. We wouldn't needlessly harm, exploit, or kill. But given we roughly share those stances, how do you think about our chances of making a better future? And that's whether it's to do with the broad influence of worldviews, our potential to persuade humanity to extend our moral scope and to adopt a more naturalistic approach, or given some of your work, the role of philosophy or public philosophy or even podcasting in, you know, shifting humanity in a better direction. But you can answer that in however you like, given the time we have left.
Well, okay, so let's begin from the easy kind of applied dimension. And I think there are a lot of things, just to keep the focus here on animals and questions of sentience and ethics, I think there are a lot of things that we can do to usher in a better future, not just for us, but for living beings, human or otherwise. And that includes giving animals meaningful protection under national and international law. It can mean respecting and protecting the natural spaces that animals need to thrive and that are currently at the risk of being devastated by human action, like pollution, war, agribusiness, so on and so forth. We can also think about building lived environments, thinking about the built environment with the needs of other animals in mind, whether that is in wild spaces or even in urban spaces. How do we build the environment that we share with other animals in ways that cause them and us to flourish together? So there are a lot of practical dimensions, and I think the animal rights movement and the animal welfare movements are moving in this direction, giving very concrete recommendations. Beyond that, I do think that a better future will require something like a perceptual shift in our understanding, not just of nature, but also of our nature and our place in nature and our relationship to other animals. And I recently, about 2 weeks ago, read a book by a French philosopher named Baptiste Morisot. And it's a book called Ways of Being Alive. And it's a book about environmental philosophy and animals. And he uses this concept that I really liked for thinking about the future. He uses the concept of wild diplomacy, which stood out for me. And in short, he suggests that one possible way of moving forward is to see ourselves as interspecies diplomats. And I stopped to think about this and I was like, well, what is going on with this concept of wild diplomacy or natural diplomacy? And I mean, what do diplomats do? You know, they go to other places in an effort to show the best that their people or their nation state represents, to create a good impression for others in an attempt to foster relationships of peaceful coexistence with difference, right? Like that's the function of a diplomat. And he says, what if we saw ourselves in our interactions with other animals as species diplomats. When I interact with that eagle over there, what kind of interaction should I pursue? Again, with this notion of diplomacy in mind. And it just sparked a lot of questions for me about shifting the starting point of our interactions with animals. Because of course, now when we start, you know, typically the questions we ask is, they tend to be either defensive. How do I avoid this animal? How do I prevent myself from being attacked by this animal? How do I neutralize this animal? Or they tend to be offensive. How do I exploit this animal? How do I make money off of this animal? How do I make this animal do labor for me? And so shifting that to a diplomatic framework for me was exciting and titillating because it meant asking questions like, how would I best represent Homo sapiens in the presence of this particular animal so that it walks away with the best impression of what humans are and represent? And of course, that's a vague answer, but I think it's one that can potentially guide in practical ways our behavior moving forward. And so that's, I mentioned that only because I recently ran into it and it's been on my mind. But the larger point to be underscored here is that whatever way forward we choose, merely practical reforms are not going to be enough in the absence of a deeper recircuiting and rewiring of our self-understanding in connection to other life forms and in connection to nature much more generally.
Yeah, which is why we still need philosophy.
Correct. And philosophy that is legible to a large and broad audience. And I do think, you know, you alluded to podcasting. I think this is something that can be done without podcasting by writing for a general audience, but it is also something that can be done very effectively by podcasting. And this is some, I mean, this has been the motivation, I'm sure, for your work in this field of public philosophy. And it certainly has been mine in my own podcast, Overthink, where our whole motto is, how do we apply philosophical ideas to the everyday? And this is harder work than it seems, because then in some ways, to use the notion of diplomacy one last time, there we're seeing ourselves as philosophical diplomats. You know, how do we present philosophy in a way that leads to understanding from non-philosophers, from non-experts, who are asking philosophical questions already in their everyday lives and who might benefit from knowing, oh, there are these conceptual resources out there. I just need a bridge to make them legible because I am not a professional philosopher and I'm not about to spend 6 months or a year reading a philosophical tradition in order to extract those insights. And so if somebody else can do that and play that pedagogical function, I do think that there is a political value to that and a moral function that is being played.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love the idea of the interspecies diplomacy idea, because it also avoids a pattern which is quite common in the animal advocacy world, which is quite understandable. You look at humanity's track record with regard to non-human sentient beings and is so brutal.
Dismal.
And so vicious that there's a strong instinct to just completely withdraw. You know, the best thing that humans and humanity can do is just back away completely. And I see the pull of that, but at the same time, whether we like it or not, we have enormous power and capability, distinctive power and capability, and responsibility should come along with that. And we have to be careful not to fall back into the hubris trap, right? But I think there is a way, there are ways, if we have the right sorts of worldviews, the right sort of philosophical shifts, that we could use our human power to radically shift the role humanity has played with respect to sentientity or sentient kind, or, you know, those other experiencing beings across the world. So there's, you know, there's a hopeful message there as well. It's not just about ending the terrible things that humanity does through agriculture and various other forms of exploitation. There's also a, you know, there's a positive story we could layer onto that if we're prudent and careful too. So before we wrap up, what's the best way of people subscribing to Overthink, buying When Animals Dream, following your work more generally, where would you point people? I'll put the usual links in the show notes, of course.
Yeah, I mean, people can reach me at my university email address if they have questions about me or my work. The easiest way also to connect with me is to listen to Overthink, which is a philosophy podcast geared for a general audience. We do episodes once every 2 weeks. Some of them are about animals and about nature, but they are about all sorts of things. They are about moral psychology, about feminism, about race theory. Anything philosophical you'll find in there. So it's a hectic, an eclectic collection that we really like. And beyond that, you know, people can get their hands on my book, When Animals Dream, and that should be available wherever people buy books, whether that's online or in physical bookstores. So I'm easy to find if you just Google my name.
That's wonderful. Thank you, David. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for being a guest on Sentientism.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Take care. You too.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?